one and all, and welcome to Film Fragments, a podcast where we take fragments of an actor, director, and genre and tell you our favorites from their catalog. My name is Brian Suffield. I'm your host, and I'm very excited to welcome you guys to this week's episode of Film Fragments, where today we're going to be talking about our favorite queer films. Pride Month is happening right now as we speak. I thought we'd take a break from talking about topics related to new releases and just focus on these films. I've wanted to do a topic like this for so long. And what better time to do it than now during Pride Month? So I'm very excited to talk about these films, and I'm very excited to welcome today's guest. Our guest today is one of my fellow colleagues over at the Rolling Tape. It is Matthew Soto. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very, very excited to be here.
I'm so excited to talk with you today about these films. But before we get into talking about them, I would just love to give you an opportunity to tell the audience a little bit about yourself, what got you into film, and why you love it so much.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am Chicago-based, but I'm originally from upstate New York. And, you know, by day I work in sales, not a very exciting life. But outside of that, I am a storyteller. I love storytelling in all forms. In high school, I was big in musical theater in school. I wrote a musical. And then when I was in college, I started working on screenplays. That's really when my love of film started to develop. It's since kind of shifted. So I do the podcast with the Rolling Tape to talk about films. I'm also writing a novel. I work on music. So I think, you know, storytelling in all mediums is very special to me. But I think film is so accessible to so many people and has so many different means of presenting itself and being interpreted. And I think it's just such a beautiful medium. And I'm so glad that podcasts like Rolling Tape and Film Fragments exist, because it gives people a chance to talk about it and not feel like that annoying friend who just wants to bother all their friends with films. It's talking to people that actually care about it.
That's the story of my life. For a long time, everyone was just like, can you shut the fuck up about movies and talk about something else? And I'm like, no, I will not shut the fuck up about movies, because that's my favorite thing to talk about. Hence why I started this podcast. Hence why I'm on the Rolling Tape. I love gushing about film. I'm really happy that you're here. And going into our topic of best queer films, obviously, this is such a broad topic. There are so many films to talk about in this genre. So when it comes to a great queer film, what do you look for in that? I mean, that's just like asking anyone, what do you look for in a film, period? But what specifically do you look for in a film that is focused on queer people and sexuality? Like, what do you look for in these kinds of films?
Yeah, I really think, you know, and it's a genre that really merits that question, because it's a very broad scale of quality when it comes to queer films. You know, there are some amazing queer films that I will not be covering today that are just not very well made, but have a whole lot of heart. And then there are other queer films that are made very well, but so much kind of try to downplay the queerness to appeal to a broader audience that it loses some of its message. And so I think when I'm looking for a great queer film, I'm looking for something that balances that. It's quality, it's well made, it's beautifully shot. There's also a message of, you know, significance. It's authentic and true to the queer experience, which is not a uniform experience. There are a lot of different angles, a lot of different sides that people can come at from this. And I think, you know, all of that it's maybe unfair, because I think non-queer films don't have to juggle so much. But I think that all comes together to make a great queer film.
I 100% agree with you on that. When you go into a film that is focused on queer characters and all these different things, you want to look for someone that finds a way of not only being faithful to the LGBTQ community, but also, queer films aren't just for people in the community. There happens to be so many queer films that are universal, where anyone can appreciate, regardless if you're a part of this community. I mean, you could just be an ally, but if you're someone that is in this community, you're looking for someone that feels very timely. And there are a lot of films here that somehow do remain timely, even when they're set so far in the past. And I love myself a good queer film. I really do appreciate these kinds of films and everything, but I'm really excited to delve into them with you today. So I just say, without further ado, let's not waste any time. Let's get into our top five queer films. So Matthew, what is your number five pick?
Yeah, so I have to say my number five was really, really difficult to pick. There were a lot of different films I thought about putting in here, and I kept swapping them out. And the one I settled on, I think, is maybe slightly controversial because it's not explicitly a queer film, but there is a strong queer subtext, and that is 1991's film Fried Green Tomatoes. This is directed by John Arnett. It features Mary Stuart Masterson, Mary Louise Parker, my beloved Kathy Bates, and Jessica Tandy. And it's controversial because, similar to another film kind of that era, The Color Purple, the novel was explicit in the homosexuality and the lesbian relationship between two of the main characters. The film adaptation, you know, being in the late 80s and early 90s, skirted around that a little bit. But I do find that the relationship between the two characters, Iggy Threadgood and Ruth Jameson, is as close to like a full-fledged realized lesbian relationship as you could get in mainstream cinema at that time. Have you seen Fried Green Tomatoes before?
I have not seen Fried Green Tomatoes.
I highly recommend it. It is a film, admittedly, you know, it's from the early 90s. It's a little dated when you watch it. This was a movie that I watched with my friends in high school because we were nerdy, and I guess we thought this sounded like a good time. But the basic premise is that Kathy Bates' character named Evelyn is kind of going through a rough patch in her marriage, and she meets this elderly woman in the nursing home who recounts a story of growing up in the South in this small kind of southern train stop town, and the race relationships there, the kind of, you know, complexities of living in the South. But it's also genuinely a love story between her and, in the film, her close friend, in the novel, her, you know, lesbian partner, and about a community of acceptance. And I think, you know, when we're talking about these queer films, I think the theme of acceptance is a very powerful one that a lot of the best films deal with. And a lot of them are obviously about the lack of acceptance and the difficulties with acceptance. And one of the nice things about this film is that it portrays it in a very accepted way. There's no real controversy. Everyone in the town kind of knows the relationship. They accept it. And it's really just, it's a beautiful film. It's a great score. Jessica Tandy was Oscar nominated in supporting actress for this film. I can never remember if it came right before or right after Driving Miss Daisy. But it's of that era.
Yeah, this came after Driving Miss Daisy. Yeah. Driving Miss Daisy was the late 80s. Yeah, that's a film that's been on my watch list for so many years. I've heard so many great things about it. The title has always caught me off guard. Fried Green Tomatoes. Like, that doesn't sound very enticing at all, but you can't always judge a film by its title. But it is one that's on my list. As soon as you said Kathy Bates, I'm like, oh, yeah, immediate watch. I love Kathy Bates. You have me at Kathy Bates. Although every time I watch her in something, I know that she's a very wholesome, sweet lady in real life, but I can't help but think of her performance in Misery, where it literally terrifies the crap out of me.
100%. That is one of my favorite best actress wins, is Kathy Bates in Misery. And coincidentally, it was right around this time. And it's funny, you know, because you have Jessica Tandy, you have Kathy Bates. You know, they were at their peak in this time period. And that's a big reason the film did so well, I think. But you're absolutely right. The title, Fried Green Tomatoes, unless you're from the South, it's a weird title. It's just not the kind of film that you're like, oh yeah, this sounds like a winner. but I implore you to try to push past it. It's one of those, it's just a nice comfort movie, and I highly recommend it if you're just looking for a nice, easy film to watch. It's got some of my favorite comedy moments as well. So I really think it's a fitting fifth film for my list of top five queer films.
And going into my number five, fittingly enough, is also a comedy. My number five, from the year of 1996, directed by Mike Nichols, written by Elaine May, The Birdcage. This is a film that I watched for the first time at the height of COVID. I had heard so many things about this movie throughout the years. You have Robin Williams playing an openly gay man who owns this drag club right outside Miami, and his life partner is played incredibly well by the always highly entertaining Nathan Lane. And Robin Williams' son is getting married, and he decides, oh, my future wife, we're gonna have her parents meet you and mom. and a whole shenanigan roller coaster starts. And my God, this film is highly entertaining in every stretch of the word. It's very out of left field because until this point, Robin Williams had never played the gay character, I believe. I think this was his first time playing this character. He was definitely the straight man of the two, and then Nathan Lane was the very flamboyant, over-the-top member of this relationship. And I mean, it is, like, it's, movies aren't as funny as this. I mean, I don't know if I just made sense saying that, but really, this is one of the funniest films I've ever seen in my life. Robin Williams and Nathan Lane, their chemistry is pure magic. I think they work off each other beautifully well. I mean, these are true comedic talents front and center. And Robin Williams at this stage in his career, like, he had gotten a few Oscar nominations. He was really established as a dramatic actor, but he was still pumping out comedy after comedy. And, I mean, this is a very straight performance from him, which is funny because he's playing a gay character in this movie. And it's great. Like, he's very good with the dry delivery of the humor. And then Nathan Lane is, he literally owns it. And I think that this performance should have been Oscar nominated. He did get some supporting actor nominations that year. But of course, the Oscars not nominating comedies ever. They decide to omit him from being nominated, which is really disappointing. And I remember the first time I saw this movie, I closed my eyes at one point, and I just thought it was the genie and Timon arguing with each other. So I kind of like to think of it that way. And then also, you have Gene Hackman in this. You have Diane Weiss, and they're an absolute delight in this. They really embrace it. Hank Azaria is really, really great in this. I don't think a lot of people talk about his performance. And oh God, who played the wife, the mom? Christine Baranski, right? Mm-hmm. She played. Yeah, she's great. She's always a delight always a to delight. Watch in this. Always a delight. And when Nathan Lane decides to dress up as the mom, I mean, that's just so great. Well, the thing with the Birdcage that's very interesting to me is that the comedy is so razor sharp. This film flies by so quickly because it's so frenetically paced. You have Mike Nichols' direction combined with Elaine May's incredible screenplay. And it's interesting, too, because I had no idea for the longest time that this was a remake of a film called La Cage a les Folies. Mm-hmm. And they adapted that into a musical. Then they made this into a film. And I don't really have too much to say other than I think it's relentlessly entertaining. I think it flies by really, really well. Mike Nichols was a true visionary filmmaker. I mean, the fact that this guy had directed so many different films, it just showed how eclectic his filmography is. Like, the fact that he did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate and Postcards from Edge and The Birdcage, Closer. I mean, the guy was really versatile with his craft, which is why I respected him so much. But I really do love The Birdcage. I know that there are some people that have said this film hasn't aged as well as it does, which is crazy to me because I still find it to be incredibly entertaining. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I watch this movie to laugh and have a good time, and so many of the best lines come from Nathan Lane. Like, he literally embraces it. Like, when Robin Williams is teaching him how to just be straight, and then the piercing the toes, and then or stroking at the toes with the jelly, then he's like, ah, I just pierced the toes. It's so good. Like, there's so many memorable lines. Armand Goldman, you old so-and-so. How about them dolphins?
It's so good.
It's so good. The Birdcage is my number five. Are you going to pass, or is this not on your list?
It's not on my list, but it is a very deserving five on your list. It's, you know, it's funny because this is a film I watched when I was a child, and this was long before I came out. And, you know, my mom was always okay with me being gay. My dad, it was a lot harder, but I think my dad really liked this film, if I remember correctly. And it is, it's a film that deals with serious kind of topics in a very, very funny way. And in a way that kind of like you said, you know, at the top of the recording, you know, some of the best films can appeal not only to the community, but to people on the whole. And I think they're universal themes, and comedy is such a universal. And I think, you know, it's fitting, you know, today with all the discussions of drag queens and trans rights, you know, it's at its core, people shouldn't have such a hard time finding humor to be humorous. It's very entertaining. I also remember there was a story about, I believe Nathan Lane, when he did this film, wasn't out yet. And there was a lot of speculation as to whether or not he was gay. And so he recounted the story of how Robin Williams very, very smoothly deflected all the comments and brought the attention over to himself to protect Nathan Lane. And mm-hmm. I just think that's always such a wonderful story about, you know, and a testament to Robin as a person.
Yeah. I remember when that article came out and that story came out when Nathan was promoting Beau Was Afraid, and it just showed how much of a respectful human Robin was and how he was always caring towards his colleagues and his fellow actors and everybody around him, which I really, really appreciate about him. And yeah, I mean, this film really is fantastic. And anyone out there that hasn't seen it, please do yourself a favor and watch it. And the ending is really one of the greats. It's so friggin' funny. Like, Nathan Lane truly should have been nominated for this. This is one of the great supporting comedic performances that I maybe have ever seen. I mean, he mm-hmm. really goes all out. He understood the assignment. He takes camp to the next level. And it's not to the point where it's annoying. Like, it doesn't...
Right. It's not a caricature.
It's not a caricature. It doesn't overstay its welcome. There's just the right amount of camp to it. Like, and his delivery of stuff is just so great. Are you kidding me? You're shaving your chest now? I didn't have time to wax now, did I?
It's so good.
It's so good. Oh, man. So now going into our number fours, what is your pick?
All right. So my number four is actually a recent watch for me. It's been on my radar for years, but I finally saw it at the start of this month. And that's 1999's But I'm a Cheerleader, directed by Jamie Babbitt and starring it's Natasha Leone, right?
Or is it Leone? I think it's one of those.
It's one of those two. Amazing performance. It is, so like I said, this is a kind of more recent watch for me, even though it's been on my radar for a long time. And boy, I am so glad that I finally did watch it. It is genuinely so funny. It's such a great satire. And I was the thing that I think surprised me about this film was I talked before about how the quality of queer films can really range. And this is not an Oscar quality film in the slightest, and it has no aspirations of being. It is just a film for a good time. It is tongue-in-cheek, it is silly, it is, you know, a little raunchy at times, but the thing that I think elevates it is that it's so full of heart. It never treats the topic in a way that's it's never making fun of the topic. It's very sincere. It's very beautiful. And the relationship between Megan and Graham, the two romantic leads, I think develops really well and really organically. And so you have this really sincere love story in the midst of pure camp and chaos and silliness. And of course, it also features a beautiful performance by RuPaul, who's playing one of the therapists there to the conversion therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So funny watching, you know, RuPaul do that role, because of course, you know, but so much of the movie is kind of just it's like a constant wink to the audience. Like, if you know, you know, and if you don't know, you're gonna learn. So I think it just balanced the topic so well. It really was very colorful, very beautiful, and I think just balanced the humor very well with the kind of more sincere aspects of it.
Absolutely. I just watched this film literally not even 48 hours ago, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's so crazy that I hadn't seen this film, because I had heard so many things about this film throughout the years, and it's crazy too, because this was not the only teen comedy that Natasha Leone was in 1999, mm-hmm. because you had this film, and then you had a completely different film, An American Pie, also that same year, which is one of my favorite comedies of all time. And yeah, Natasha Leone is incredible in this. She is fantastic. I think really, if her performance didn't work, I don't think the film would have worked at all. Agreed. It's really on her shoulders, and she does a fantastic job, and her chemistry with who plays the Clea DuVall.
Clea DuVall. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's great. By the way, directed a great queer film that unfortunately is not on my list, Happiest Season. That's a fantastic film.
Oh, that was so close to being my number five.
It was so close to being in my list, too. Love it. Great, great film. Anyone out there that hasn't seen it, watch it. And if you want a perfect Christmas movie to watch that's queer and everything, that's the one right there. Yeah, I loved But I'm a Cheerleader, and I told you off air that I think that when I watch it again, and I certainly will be watching it again, it will definitely go up, and my appreciation for it will spike tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, my number four, now I had told you off air that I was going to cheat a little bit. As the host of this show, I could do whatever the hell I want. It's my show, and I could do whatever I want. Every once in a while, I like to incorporate some piece of television on the list. Now, I don't put straight-up TV shows on because there's just so much, unless if it's a limited series. There have been a few times where we talked about limited series or TV movies or what have you. But this is a massive cheat for me because this is technically not a limited series, but it's an anthology series. Now, when I give a hint of what it is that I'm talking about, I feel like everyone's going to know right away. There is a particular show that has this global phenomenon, this global success, where people watch these episodes that have nothing to do with one another, and it creeps everybody out in the possible way, the best possible way. But then comes along this one episode, and it is the only episode in this series thus far that is labeled as a happy episode. And if you know what I'm talking about, ladies and gentlemen, I am talking about Black Mirror, mm-hmm. Saint Junipero. I'm a big fan of Black Mirror. The recent season just dropped at the time of this recording. Literally today was when the new season dropped. And as soon as we get off this call, I will start watching this new season because all I want is for it to be better than the last season. That's all I'm asking for. But Saint Junipero is, to me, still, and I think will forever be, the best episode of Black Mirror ever produced. And I remember when I was binging Black Mirror not too long after season 4 came out. And Saint Junipero, I remember not knowing what this episode was about, but I remember seeing lists. And everyone had said that this was the best episode of Black Mirror. I remember seeing the image of Mackenzie Davis and, I never know how to pronounce her name, Gugu Mbatha Raw, is that her name?
I think that's right.
So I remember seeing the picture of them in the bathroom just looking at each other. And I was under the impression that this was going to be like some horror thriller-esque episode where one of them was a creep and then they started this bond and then something happened. It's the complete opposite. Yes, it does take a sci-fi approach to it, but then it incorporates this really beautiful and earnest love story in it. And that's not something we were used to seeing on Black Mirror. We definitely got some love stories incorporated with some of the episodes, but not to this extent where it really was a straight-up love story. This episode wasn't thrilling in the slightest. It was unpredictable. The twist in this episode definitely caught me off guard, and I'm sure it caught you off guard and everyone else off guard. But this episode is amazing. It's one of the best episodes of television that I honestly have ever seen. I remember watching this with my roommate in college, and my roommate never cries to anything. He never cried to anything. I turned over to him. It's about 2 in the morning when we're watching this, and he's a fucking blubber and mess. And I'm just like, oh my God. And I mean, those two performances are literally incredible.
So
like
good.
They're so good together and separately. And then when you see what actually is going on, it makes you even more heartbroken. Like, it really just leaves a feeling in your stomach that you weren't expecting. You were expecting one thing when you watch a Black Mirror episode. It leaves you very uncomfortable, but this left you devastated, emotionally devastated. But then it left you moved by the end, just because of what goes down. And I'm not going to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it. But if you haven't watched Black Mirror, you absolutely should do that. Some of the best episodes of television in the past decade have come from this show. And I will admit that while the show has definitely lost its spunk these last few seasons, this really is the grand opus, the magnum opus of Black Mirror. These performances are great. It won the Emmy for Outstanding Television Film. I believe it also took home the Ryan Emmy, which is really good because the dialogue here is impeccable. Mm-hmm. It's beautifully directed. The colors in this are so striking. And the themes of finding your love, even if it's much later in your life. And the idea of them traveling through different decades and everything is so fucking cool, in my opinion. I really think this is the coolest Black Mirror episode today. I really do straight up think that this is the best Black Mirror has ever been. And it's unfortunate that they've never found a way of making an episode as good as this. But at the same time, it's a good thing because it's going to be really hard to come up with an episode for that show that is on the same level of incredible as Saint Junipero. So I would assume this is not on your list, but I would just love to hear your thoughts on this beautiful episode of television.
Yeah, it is not on my list. I'm actually glad I didn't know, because if I had known like a limited series could be in the top five, this would have made it so much harder for me, because I think there are a number of those that could have easily gone on the list. But I think you did such a wonderful job of explaining that and capturing, again, what makes it such a quality choice and a quality queer. It you know, it is a film, in essence, you know, even though, mm-hmm. of course, it's not, you know, a direct film in the way that we technically mean it. But I think, you know, I think it, you're exactly right in that it captures what Black Mirror does so, so well, in that it catches us off guard. It puts us in a position that we don't expect. And as you said, the quality of Black Mirror varies. There are some really great episodes. There are some that I don't think a Black Mirror episode is ever bad. I think there are just some that are exceptionally good, and this mm-hmm. is absolutely one of those.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen this one in quite a while, so now I feel like I have to immediately go back and rewatch this one.
I watch this episode at least once every year. It's really like a very cathartic experience, and the needle drop at the end of Heaven is a Place on Earth. Mm-hmm. You know, I was always into that song. Like I've always loved that song. I've always found it to be a bop. It's really beautiful and everything. But now whenever I think of that song, I think of this, and it's hard to like really think of it, because now when I think of that beautiful song, I start to get emotional because I think of this particular episode. It's similar to how now I can never listen to Under Pressure the same way again because of After Sun.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep. That's how
we
it
just
works.
We love whenever people use these bops of music and then find a way of making us feel like crap afterwards. But this really is this is a really extraordinary episode of television. Of the past 10 years, this is one of the best episodes that has been produced on television. And this was when Netflix officially picked up Black Mirror, because originally Netflix just distributed, but now Netflix is the sole producer of the show. So they got a bigger budget, they got bigger names, they had bigger scope, they had the opportunity to do whatever they wanted. And I don't know how much this episode cost on the top of my head. I think like around the $10-15 million mark. It looked incredible. It was shot beautifully. The production design alone was immaculate. And I mean, but that's the thing with Black Mirror, is that on a technical level, it's always well made. I mean, they really put all the money mm-hmm. into the technical aspect. And people think that the only show that Netflix puts their money towards is Stranger Things. And that's absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, you watch this show and you see the technical side of it, and it's very well made. You could say what you want about the episode stories or some of the performances and the writing, but on a technical level, this show is really, really excellent. And Saint Junipero really is the best episode of this show. And it's just crazy, too, because again, a lot of these episodes end on very depressing notes.
Yep.
And yeah, this episode may not end on the most uplifted note, but it's a very feel-good ending.
Yes.
How often can you watch an episode of Black Mirror and be like, "Oh, that was so great," instead of being like,
"Oh, God, yeah."
Like, literally, that's a live reaction of every single Black Mirror episode. And I guarantee you every episode of this new season is similar to that. I'm sure every single one's going to be like, "Oh, my God." Like, and I hope they're good. I hope so, too. And now going into our number threes, what is your pick?
Before I jump to number three, I did just want to plug, if and if I had had an idea and I wanted to choose an anthology that I would put on my list, I would have put The Haunting of Bly Manor probably on my list. It's I absolutely love it. A lot of people did not love it because it wasn't quite as scary as Haunting of Hill House. But it's based on one of my favorite novellas, which is Turn of the Screw, but also incorporates what I think is one of the most beautiful lesbian romances that's ever been on TV.
I need to watch that. I haven't seen Hill House or Bly Manor.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, I'm so hit or miss with Mike Flanagan.
You told me that, yeah.
Mike Flanagan literally made me want to end my life after I saw Dr. Sleep.
Oh, I know, but you have to give it a try.
I'm sure I'll like it. And then the other show he did, Midnight Mass, I heard that's really good.
Probably one of my top five favorite shows was Midnight Mass.
I heard that that was like on a whole other level, and it looked so good, and I just get worried that I'm going to sit down to watch this guy's stuff and I'm just going to be like, I hate you for what you did to Dr. Sleep. I can't entirely blame you, but like, you really fucked me up with Dr. Sleep and how it just ruined everything for me.
We could have had something good. Yes.
I know. We could have had something good, Mike, and you just had to fuck it up. For me, at least. I know I'm in the minority. I know a lot of people like Dr. Sleep. But what's your number three? Yes. I'm really excited to hear what your number three is.
Yeah, so my number three is a film that surprisingly I have not seen until about 7 months ago. But it is now a perennial Christmas watch. Similar to Happiest Season, but very different film. And this will be 2015's Carol. Directed by Todd Haynes, of course, starring Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. People had told me for a long time I was going to love this film, and I guess I believed them. I was not prepared to love a film as much as I loved this film. This is genuinely, I think, one of the most stunning, beautiful films I can think of. It's so well acted. It's so well shot. You have beautiful costumes by Sandy Powell, who I always love to give a shout out just because I think she's incredible. And, you know, Kate Blanchett may not technically be a lesbian, but if there's ever been a canonically accepted non-lesbian into the community, it's Kate Blanchett. She's done it in Tar. She's done it in Carol. She can do it in anything. She earns it. I even read a review of Disney's Cinderella that was like, man, Kate Blanchett just once again bringing a non-queer character and making it as queer as possible. Such a good film, so beautiful. And I know you've seen Carol before, of course.
Yeah, I've seen it. Do you have anything else to say about Carol?
There's so much to say. It's, you know, and it does one of my favorite things is one of my favorite things is a Christmas movie that's not actually about Christmas and mm-hmm. is maybe only briefly about Christmas, but it captures the spirit of Christmas. And this is absolutely one of those films that, you know, I will forever think of it. Just the magic of the department store and the way that they meet, the connection. It's so much. And I have a feeling this might be on your list, maybe.
Well, you are correct. It is my number three as well, fittingly enough. I adore this movie so much. It's so crazy to me that I saw this not too long after it came out, but I wasn't as wowed by it as everybody else was. And my taste in film was so different when this came out almost 10 years ago, which is nuts. I cannot believe it's been almost 10 years since this thing's come out. I literally remember the first time I saw the trailer for this and I heard that Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara were playing lesbians. And I'm like, yes, give it to me now, please. Yep. But this is such a seductive film. Like, it really finds a way of crawling under your skin. Like, it's very slow. It takes its time building the relationship. But this is not the only time that I'll be talking about a film that does something like that. But Cate Blanchett is, honestly, she might be the best actress working today. I really think that she might just be the best mm-hmm. we have. Her and Kate Winslet, who also has played the on-screen lesbian before,
yep.
I think they're the best actresses working today. And I'm waiting for the day where they play lesbians together. Oh, like, man. That's going to make everybody explode. That is going to probably, that is going to be the day where I think film Twitter literally crashes.
Yep.
Everybody is going to die. This is going to be one of those times where everybody is excited for something. This is going to be equivalent to basically when Parasite won Best Picture. Everybody was happy. Everybody was cheering and hollering, and that's how it's going to be. If there's ever a film that comes out where Kate Winslet and Kate Blanchett play lesbians, and I don't know who directs it, maybe Todd Haynes, maybe Todd Field, I don't know. It could be anybody, but yeah, Carol, it's so cool how you brought up how this is a Christmas movie that's also not a Christmas movie, where Christmas isn't the main focus, but it's obviously set around Christmas time. And I mean, the imagery here is so striking. You brought up the department store, and yeah, I just love the look of it so much. The production design work is impeccable, mm-hmm. and the score by Carter Burwell is amazing. Yep. It's one of the best scores that he's ever done. He's a very underappreciated composer, in my opinion. And the imagery, like I said, is striking. But, you know, that first encounter between between Carol and Terry, would probably feel the same way as Terry if someone as alluring as Kate Blanchett comes up saying, "Is this a good doll to buy?" Like, I don't know what I would say. I would probably just go, I would freak out in that moment. And
it shouldn't have been as sexy as it was, but no, damn.
That's the thing. You look at like a period drama and you're gonna be like, "Oh, this is gonna be just a slog and it's gonna be boring," but it's so sexy, and not in the conventional way either, which I really appreciate. And these two performances are incredible. This might be my favorite acting that Rooney Mara has ever done. I really think that this might be the best acting she's ever done. And to say if this is Kate Blanchett's best work, I mean, that's tough, because I mean the woman's is a chameleon. She's given so many incredible performances throughout the years. I mean, what she just did in Tar was next level. I didn't think that she would find a way of topping Carol or Blue Jasmine or any of her other Oscar performances, but she finds a way of doing it, and she'll probably top Tar in the next five years, where she delivers another like Oscar caliber performance. But she's incredible. Rooney's incredible. The entire cast surrounding them is incredible. Kyle Chandler freaked me out so much.
100%.
In this, I love Kyle Chandler. I think he's one of the most underrated actors working today, so I love seeing him in this. Yeah, I mean, this film is also very cozy at the same time. It's like a nice film that you like to watch in the winter. Like, you're cozed up by a fire and you have a cup of hot cocoa and you're watching it. But then you got to make sure you don't drink hot cocoa when the scenes happen, because then it's going to make you spit it out, because you're just like, wow, this is really just amazing. There are so many, like, there are probably people that, like, straight women who probably will be like, "Oh, I would go gay for both of them." Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
I remember there was this one person that I was friends with in college who's straight, and she's like, "You know, I'm not into women, but watching Carol, it made me into Kate and Rooney for a while." It's just such a beautiful film, too. I mean, it ends on an incredibly devastating note. And the last sequence between the two of them, I mean, that stuck with me when I was – when I first saw the movie almost a decade ago, and I wasn't as into the movie, but then I rewatched it just a little under a year ago, and I mean, I was speechless.
Yep.
And in the back of my head, I wish that this had gotten more awards love throughout the season, because Kate got nominated everywhere, Rooney got nominated everywhere, the screenplay got nominated, but it should have been in for picture. Mm-hmm. Todd Haynes should have gotten a director nomination. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I still think this might be the only Todd Haynes film that I've seen. I have seen Far From Heaven, and I do like that one, but I need to really sit down and go through his filmography, especially before his new film, May December, comes out.
So excited for that one.
Which sounds amazing. Yep. Like, I thought it was just going to be a regular drama, but apparently it's campy, and they just rated it like a hardcore R
so
today.
Excited.
And I cannot wait. I cannot wait. I hope to see that in a theater with a crowd of people, where people are hollering and having a good time. I cannot imagine what it was like being in that can crowd watching the movie. Yeah, Carol is really extraordinary. And would I have given either of these women the Oscars? Honestly, it's tough because I look back at who was nominated that year. So the person that I feel should have won Best Supporting Actress that year was Kate Winslet for Steve Jobs. She should have won the Oscar, but the fact that she lost to a person that I love, Alicia Vikander, but she won for the wrong movie.
Yeah.
She, like, Ex Machina was the far superior performance that year. And this is no diss to anybody that likes The Danish Girl, and she was very good in that movie, but that was not, in my opinion at least, an Oscar-winning performance whatsoever.
It was an
Rooney would
Oscar-nominated performance, but
Oscar
I would
nominated for
not have
sure.
given it the I wouldn't have given it the
Absolutely.
award, yeah.
Absolutely. I agree. That whole year of acting wins was just so bizarre. Like, the only good acting win was, I'm trying to think of who won Best Actress that
I
year. I
know, I'm
don't
trying to
remember.
remember.
That was the year the Spotlight won Picture. Who the heck won Best Actress that year? Oh my God. Fact check live on the air.
It's gonna
Let's
kill me.
see. Let's see. It won. Well, first of all, this film won no Oscars, which is sickening. Sickening. Best Actress went to Brie Larson for Room.
Oh, that's right.
That was a great performance. That's a very good performance.
Yeah.
And I love Leo, but well, yeah, he shouldn't have won Best Actor. I'm
No,
sorry.
that was not.
Mark Rylance stole Sylvester Stallone's Oscar. Sylvester Stallone should have won for Creed. And then either Kate Winslet or Rooney Mara should have won supporting actress. Although Jennifer Jason Leigh for The Hateful Eight would have been a really cool win. That
Yeah.
would have been an awesome win. But yeah, Carol is incredible, and there's so much to be said that obviously has been said already. So yeah, if you haven't seen Carol, what are you doing? Please watch it.
Please go
Like,
watch it. You're missing out. Also,
you
Sarah
really.
Paulson.
Sarah
You
Paulson
know,
crushing it.
one of the things that I loved about Carol was that, you know, Sarah Paulson, I think having, you know, having the experience and being an actual part of the community really did such a powerful job of anchoring the film, and just she did such a good job portraying the nuances of heartbreak and moving on and making amends with your former lovers. And I think, you know, Rooney and Kate did such a commanding job that I think people sometimes forget Sarah Paulson was in it, and yet I have to give that a shout out because as part of our community, she gave an authenticity that I think was so important in grounding Carol and not having it just being dismissed as, oh, it's just, you know, people fantasizing about what they think this could be like. It was a very real, genuine connection, I think.
It really was. And again, like, the movie is so reliant on the chemistry. Like, a lot of these romances, their sole focus is to have great chemistry between the two people that are playing the lovers in the film. And if their chemistry doesn't work, the entire film would not work.
Yep.
And thankfully, Todd Haynes entrusting Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara to play lovers. Again, these are two people that they're allies of the community, clearly, but they're not members of the community. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there that are like, oh, why do we keep casting straight actors to play these characters? And I totally understand that, but this is one of those examples where it works.
Yep.
It absolutely works. And they deliver great performances. And it's a great film, really. If you haven't seen it, please do yourself a favor and check it out. So this is definitely not our only overlap. I'm so curious to hear our top two. I have a feeling of what one of those films is, but I have no idea what the other film in your top two is. So what is your second favorite queer film of all time?
Yeah, so I really think this one is gonna catch you off guard because a lot of people don't know it. It is not an English language film. And this is actually a film that I just happened to stumble on Netflix about 4 or 5 years ago. And it's a Brazilian film called The Way He Looks. In Portuguese, it's Hoje Eu Quero Voltar Sozinho. I want to go home alone. And this is a Brazilian film in 2014. I believe opened in the Berlin International Film Festival and was actually Brazil's nominated film for international feature at the Oscars, even though it did not win the nomination. But this is a film based on a short film, actually. It's one of the only cases I can think of where a short film was extended into a feature length film and it warranted that extension. But the basic summary is that there is a high schooler who is blind, has his best friend and kind of his way of life. He's used to life. He has his family, he has his friends. And then a new boy moves into school and befriends him and ends up kind of unintentionally driving a rift between him and his best friend. And it is the way I would kind of describe it is like Heartstopper, which is one of my absolute favorite series, meeting Luca, Disney Pixar's Luca, if it was actually a queer film. Luca was a contender on this list for me, even though it is not explicitly a gay film. And I don't think it is a queer film, but I think the beauty of it is that it has nuances that as a young queer person, I was like, oh my God, I remember these feelings of jealousy and liking a boy and being so close as friends and then being jealous of a girl. And so this film really balances that. It's very nuanced performances. And this is one of the few films where it's a genuinely happy ending. These are high schoolers and they have their regular high school angst and drama. So there's jealousy, there's heartbreak, there's, you know, mixed signals and uncertainty as to whether or not you like a girl or a boy or whatever it may be. But in the end, the two boys do end up together and making a powerful statement. And it's so refreshing to see that in a queer love story because, of course, as we all know, you know, queer stories are ripe for tragedy. They are so often some of the most powerful, heartbreaking films we can find. But unfortunately, so many people only ever see heartbreak and pain in queer stories. And while that is an important part of the queer experience, it is not the only part. And so this is a film that is refreshing in its joy and its openness and its comfort. I highly recommend it. I think currently you can find it maybe on like Amazon Prime. But it is worth kind of if you're not a person who can deal well with foreign language films and you struggle with subtitles, give it a try for this film because it genuinely is I think one of the most beautiful queer love stories in modern cinema.
That sounds excellent. That sounds very, very good. I'm going to add that to the watch list for sure. I'm definitely going to check that out. It sounds really, really wonderful and I cannot wait to watch it. My number two, I am shocked that this didn't make your list. I'm truly, truly shocked that this didn't make your list. So a little bit of history with this film for me. I remember my first time attending the New York Film Festival a couple of years ago, and I had looked at the lineup, and I saw that this film was playing there. I hadn't really heard much about it other than it played at Cannes to massive critical acclaim, very high amount of acclaim. And a lot of people were buzzing about it, and they said, keep an eye on this film. This could be one of the major frontrunners for Best International Feature or Best Foreign. I don't know if it was called International Feature or Foreign Film at the time. And I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. So I decided to get a ticket. I had no idea what the film was about. I saw the image and I'm like, all right, sure, I'm in. I sit down to watch the movie. And when it ended, I said to myself, this is 100% one of the best romances that I have ever seen in my life. This is one of the most realistic romances I probably have ever watched. It's one of the most beautifully shot films I've ever seen. And I had said to myself that if this is not nominated for the Oscar, I will be pissed. And it somehow was not this country's submission for the International Feature Oscar. From 2019, Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Of course.
I went into this film really not knowing what to expect. I had no idea that this was a queer romance. I had no idea what to expect. I just thought it was about a woman who was being painted and that was it. And yes, a woman does get painted. There is a painting of a woman happening in this movie. A portrait, excuse me. And this is another film similar to Carol, where it slowly builds the romance. It crawls under your skin. It really finds a way of easing its way up and not rushing into anything, which I love. I feel that so many romances nowadays, and I should have brought this up with Carol, I feel like so many romances nowadays just rush everything. Like, they just go so quickly and everything. But then you get a film like Carol and now Portrait of a Lady on Fire, where it builds itself. It's very quiet. It's very slow. It's very common. But it leaves you feeling so many different things. The two lead performances are incredible. They're incredible. I mean, these two women, I mean, first of all, they are so incredibly gorgeous, both of them. They are so alluring. Literally both of them are alluring. And it's, you can't take your eyes off the screen because of how striking their performances are. And, you know, this woman is assigned to paint this portrait of this woman getting married and everything. But the person that's getting married clearly does not want to get married. She doesn't want to follow the rules. She wants to do her own thing. And she opens up to the painter. And when the tension builds to this romance, I mean, it really just leaves your jaw dropping on the floor. I remember the first time I watched this, when I saw it at NIFF, and I saw it right after Pain and Glory, which is another great queer film, by the way. That's another fantastic film. I just had no idea how to articulate what I had watched. I was just so infatuated by what was going on screen, not only through the performances and the writing, but the jaw-droppingly, utterly spectacular imagery by the always captivating Claire Mathison. Mm-hmm. Claire Mathin, whatever her name is. I'm sorry that I butchered her name. She has done some of the finest imagery these last few years. I think her cinematography for Spencer was also very overlooked by the Academy. But she shot this beautifully. The music choices were here. But this is really Celine Sciamma's baby. She's the star of the show. Her writing is electrifying. Her directing is captivating. This is a film that clocks in under 2 hours. Does it feel long? It does. It takes its time. And this is one of those scenarios to where if this film moved faster, the impact would not have hit as hard as it did. Because it was so slow and it was building everything up, I really love that aspect. And again, this is a film where you don't have to be a member of this community to appreciate it. There are so many people that I know that aren't members of this community that absolutely adored this film and ate it up. Because it's one of the most raw, powerful romances to come out in recent memory. This has slowly become one of my favorites of the entire genre. And the fact that this got no Oscars, nothing, and France really made a big mistake by not having this as their submission for the International Feature Oscar. The film that they ended up submitting was Les Miserables, which has in no relation to Les Miserables, the musical. It's its own thing. It was focusing on the riots that were going on in Paris. It was a very good film. I do recommend it. It was very strong, but it was not on the level of good as Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Now, granted, no international feature that year was, to me and I think to a lot of people, as strong as Parasite. I mean, that was a really great year for film, period. Yes. There was a lot of great international films. There was a lot of great films, period. But Portrait of a Lady on Fire, in my opinion, was the second best international feature that year. It was in my top 10 that year. I just walked out of the movie just in a flood of tears, and then the Q&A happened afterwards, and it was just one of the coolest Q&As. And then to find out that, hold on, I'm going to load up the name of the actress, because I really should. I mean, shout out to Naomi Merlant and Adele Hanel. When I found out that Celine Sciamma and Adele Hanel used to date, I was shocked. I don't know if I found that out at the Q&A or if I found out after the movie, but in the back of my head, I'm like, how did they make this movie together? And since they're not a thing anymore, but I mean, I'm glad they have maintained a great friendship with one another and a great partnership with one another when making films. And really, this is truly one of the best romances that I have ever seen. I knew that when we were doing this topic, I knew I could not have it on my list. I knew this had to make the top five, especially the top two, because of the impact it left with me. And I've seen this film a couple of times. I bought the Criterion the day it came out, and I've recommended this film to so many people, and everyone was speechless. Everyone was just like, blown away, and it has one of the greatest endings I think I may have ever seen on screen. That ending is so incredible with the music underlying it, the coverage, the blocking, everything is just, the editing is just so incredible. Really, I just don't understand how this didn't get nominated for anything. Like, if you're not going to nominate for international feature, at least nominate for cinematography, mm-hmm. for costumes, production design,
something.
Literally anything. You could have put this in the top 10 of the Oscars. You could have nominated 2 international features. Come on, Academy. Grow some fucking balls and do something about it. So, Portrait of Lady on Fire is my number 2. So, what is your opinion on this film?
So, this is... So it's funny because before we started recording, I told you that in doing my research, I realized there were some very large blind spots. And this is probably going to shock you. I have not seen this film. I know.
Oh, my God.
There is literally because our friend Danny, I raved about it when it came out. And it's always been on my radar and I've just not yet seen it, even though I've seen the pictures. I've even listened to the score. I just haven't seen the film yet. So this is going to be like a probably tonight or tomorrow. I'm going to be watching this movie.
Oh, my God.
I know. Like, I know.
You are not going to be the same person. Person after you watch this movie, you're literally gonna be like, the way you were. I remember when you texted all of us that you had watched Carol for the first time. it's gonna be a similar reaction.
I think that's why I haven't seen it yet. I think I'm like afraid of how much it's gonna impact me. So I'm gonna wait a few years and then I watch it. Yeah.
Well, that's why you watch a really funny movie after that.
You
watch a really funny movie to put you in a good mood
in a better place.
You're gonna feel like. I can't even properly describe how brilliant this film wraps up. I just can't even properly describe it, but it's so incredible, and it really is disgusting that this got no love. And I would just love to know why the I don't know who's in charge of submitting these international films. Like, I don't know if it's like I don't know, but the point is, like, whoever decided to not submit Portrait of Lady on Fire is really, really sickening. They probably didn't think the Academy was going to nominate a film like this, and maybe it wouldn't have. I have no idea, but...
It should have. It was a missed opportunity, for sure.
It was a really big mistake on their part. It was a huge, huge mistake on their part. And, I mean, they wouldn't have won anyway, because, I mean, Parasite was...
It's just such a good movie.
It really is. I mean, it really is one of the best films ever made.
Yep.
And speaking of one of the best films ever made, it's time that we talk about our number one film. Now, this is a film that did get a lot of Oscar nominations. This is a film that got so much critical acclaim. This is a film that premiered at Sundance in January, didn't come out until early December, and somehow managed to maintain the strong buzz that it garnered at that festival at the start of that year. And it was successful at the end of the year, got a lot of award nominations, it won a couple of awards. Matthew, what is that film that I am hinting at right now?
That film is going to be Call Me By Your Name.
Your name and I'll call you by mine. Oh my God. So why is this your number one queer film of all time?
Oh, I mean, it's funny because the movie had its wide release in January and my birthday is in January. So... at the time, my partner at the time was a flight attendant. He was gone for my birthday. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to take myself to the movies. Have a nice feel-good birthday movie. Oh, my God. It was like three people in the movie theater. It was me and two other random gay men sitting in like different corners of the theater. And I made it pretty far in without crying. But if I ever had to tell you what my absolute favorite ending of a movie is, it is the final scene into the credits of Call Me By Your Name. I mean, this absolutely devastated me, and it's funny because I've seen it, I think, three times. I watched it in the theaters, I watched it on an airplane. Let me tell you, that peach scene on an airplane, one of the most uncomfortable experiences I've ever had. And then I just rewatched it today, and it's interesting because my love for the movie has not changed. It is still a 5-star, it is still my number one queer film. But I've picked up on so many nuances that I think I missed the first time, because when the movie first came out, I felt closer in age and maturity to Elio. And now that I'm older, I'm closer in age and experience to Oliver. And I didn't realize all the nuance there. And, you know, having been a younger gay and now maturing a little bit, there's so much more to it. But I'm sure we're going to dive into that. I just want to call out how beautiful a film this is. I mean, it is, you know, if Carol is the perfect movie to give you Christmas vibes and it's so seasonal and warm and cozy, this film is like the embodiment of summer. When I think of summer, Call Me By Your Name captures the sweatiness of it, the heat of it, the kind of haze of summer. And I love films that can capture a season so powerfully and evocatively.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. This film literally changed my life in so many ways. I remember walking into the film. I had seen the trailer and I thought it looked quite good. I wasn't like super over the moon excited to see it because romance movies to me are so hit or miss. I have to like really love it. Like, I want a good romance movie to be the raw, realistic romances. There's nothing wrong with the cheesy ones. There's nothing wrong with the sappy ones and everything. I just prefer the very raw, genuinely realistic romances. My father and my sister love to make fun of me for not liking Nicholas Sparks movies. And look, there are some of them that are fun to watch. Like, The Notebook is actually a really good movie. I do like The Notebook. But all the other Nicholas Sparks movies, I cannot stand. I'm so sorry
to the Nicholas Sparks. Have you not seen A Walk to Remember?
I mean, that one's pretty good, too. But to be honest,
it's pretty sappy and sweet.
But the thing that I love about that movie the most is that song
she
sings is incredible. I mean, it's so good. I'm Mandy Moore. I mean, oh my God, literal mommy first of all. And when she played the mom on This Is Us, oh, she was mommy for sure. and then when they tried to make her look older, I'm like, she could still get it.
Yep, 100%.
They didn't do a good job at hiding it and everything, but with Call Me By Your Name, I remember just hearing everybody talk about this at Sundance. Everyone was like, this is the film to look out for this year. It's going to be a major awards player, depending on when it comes out. And then Sony Pictures Classics picked up the film, and they set it for a late 2017 release. So everyone's like, perfect timing, coming out at the end of the year. The Academy loves to look at those kinds of films. And I did this on a day where I did a triple feature that, quite frankly, I've done many triple features, quadruple features at film festivals, but this was my first time I ever did a triple feature. I had done a plethora of double features before, but this was a triple feature. I saw three films back to back with very little breaks in between. So I saw Darkest Hour, and then I saw this, and then I saw Shape of Water. Imagine seeing three drastically different films. You see a historical drama in Darkest Hour, which I wasn't super high on that film. And then you see a romance, a coming-of-age romance in this. And then you see a romance where a woman fucks a fish. Imagine the emotions that were going through my head that day when I saw all three of these different movies. All three, by the way, were nominated for Best Picture, which is crazy.
Yep.
And one of them won Best Picture, which is insane. But Call Me By Your Name, I mean, this has really become one of my all-time favorite films. This might be my favorite romance that I've ever seen. And again, this is another film that feels very universal because it's not just about exploring your sexuality and it's not just a queer film and everything, but it's a film focusing on first love. We've all gone through this throughout our life, and I think having the character of Elio as a 17-year-old, I think was perfect because when you're around that age, that's where you really start to develop your first love. And I remember when this movie came out, I was in my first serious relationship with someone, and she wasn't a big movie fan. She wasn't super high on films and everything. But I remember watching this film. I went to the theater to go see it, like I said, for this triple feature. I think I was the only person in there that was not with a significant other. I think I was the only one by myself. And it was packed. It was a Saturday afternoon. It was like one of those local art house theaters where the tickets were very cheap and the seats weren't the best and everything. But you could tell that you're surrounded by people who actually really love film. And those are my favorite kind of environments because, look, I love going to see big budget blockbusters. I have a good time when I see those, but I'm someone that really loves to be surrounded by film geeks when I see movies like this. Like, obviously, I saw Past Lives a few weeks ago, and it has not left my head. I'm happy I saw that in New York. One, because it's set in New York, and two, you're going to be surrounded by avid film geeks. Matt, you used to live in New York, yep, so I'm sure you know exactly. Yep, exactly. I'm sure you know exactly how it is. But with Calling by Your Name, I mean, this film really left me feeling things that I really was not anticipating. I mean, I was thinking so much about my first love and everything during that film, and like discovering who I was and what I was into and everything. And it's really not just like coming to your terms with sexuality, but it's also coming to terms with growing up and figuring out and who you are as a person. And that's what makes this such a universal story. And I love it to pieces. I mean, this film, everything about this film is masterful. First of all, I mean, you gotta talk about the performances. Timothy Chalamet really is incredible in this. And, you know, a lot of people are like, oh my God, everyone needs to shut up about Timothy. But it's so hard to do so because he really is one of the most talented actors that we have working today. And he, I don't know who said this, but someone online years ago, I think, called him the Daniel Day-Lewis of his generation. Ooh. And honestly, I could kind of see that. Daniel Day-Lewis is a guy with so many multitudes and layers, and Timothy has invoked so many layers. Like, he's done practically every kind of film possible,
yep,
and he's only 27 years old. I mean, he's done his fair share of romances, coming-of-age films. He's done a big-budget blockbuster in Dune. Mm-hmm. He's worked with so many incredible filmmakers like Wes Anderson, and say what you want about him, but he's worked with someone like Adam McKay. You never would have pictured Timothée Chalamet working with someone like Adam McKay. And now he's about to play Willy Wonka in a musical. I'm still very like, I don't want a Willy Wonka movie that's not with Gene Wilder, but if anyone's going to play a young Willy Wonka, it's going to be Timothy, especially now in this stage of his career. And I'm so excited to see that. But he is incredible as Elio, and this is one of my all-time favorite Oscar nominations.
Yep.
He was only 22 when he got this nomination. Everyone else was like an older man. He was up against, fiddly enough, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yep.
He was up against Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour, who won. Denzel got nominated for Roma J. Israel, Esquire. And Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out. Like, that was a pretty interesting stacked lineup of Best Actor nominees, and I mean, Timothy should have won.
He absolutely should have won.
Like, he should have won. I'm so sorry. Look, I love Gary Oldman. He's a great actor, and he was very good as Winston Churchill, but that was just a career Oscar. That was not a award for the performance. And I hate to say it, I don't mean to disrespect the people who love Darkest Hour. I know there are some fans of it out there, but that was the most baity performance of all the bait that you could ever imagine. But Timothy was great, and I, even though it's hard to talk about this person now, you cannot deny how good Armie Hammer is so in this movie.
Yep.
I mean, he really is incredible in this, and again, the chemistry between him and Timothy is really next level. It's really, really brilliant, and I've always loved hearing stories about when they were making this film and when they rehearse, you know, their first kiss scene out in the field, and how Lucas just like, just kiss each other, just kiss. And then they, like, went all out, and then Luca was gone. And I remember watching a clip of them talking about that. I think they were on Ellen when they were talking about that. And I think that's hilarious. I think that's hysterical. But, yeah, I mean, again, the romance builds up. It's very slow, and it creeps up onto you, and it's very sensual and everything. But, like you brought up, this film captures the summer so beautifully. I've never been to Italy in my life, and I'll be honest, the first time I go to Europe, if I ever do that, Italy low-key is the first place I want to go to because I want to do the Call Me By Your Name tour. That's the first thing I want to do. I mean, the imagery here is so fucking gorgeous. It is so good, and I love how they shot this on film. There's so much grain invoked here, especially in the sequences shot at night.
Yes.
There's a great shot of him just walking around being like, where's Oliver? And it's when Fetal Devices is playing.
Yep.
And it's just him looking around, and you just see his silhouette. It's so incredible. And I believe they actually only shot this on one lens. Like, they would go do close-ups. Like, they wouldn't zoom in or anything. They would just have one distinct lens. And that's – you don't really hear about that very often. Mm-hmm. I went to film – I was in film school when this movie came out, and I just remember hearing about that, and I'm like, that's incredible. And the music, too. I mean, holy shit.
Oh, holy shit. Yeah. Yep.
First of all, the opening that is over those opening credits, which, by the way, are some of the coolest opening credits that I've ever seen. It's just so simplistic. It's so simple. This movie is very simple. It doesn't have a villain. It doesn't make you think. Like, it's not the most thought-provoking movie. It doesn't leave anything unanswered. It's just a very simple narrative. But it's slow, and it takes its time building up to what it is that it's trying to invoke to you. And I mean, those two performances are next level. They're both great. I don't know how Army was not nominated for an Oscar, but really,
yeah.
As everybody online has said, these last 6 years, the true MVP of Call Me By Your Name is Michael Stuhlbarg as Elio's father.
Oh, it just, like, I can't get over it.
So there was a tweet that went around the other day naming the best movie parents. I put both of Elio's parents. Like, they are literally the best parents I think I've ever seen on a film.
Yep.
And they're so supportive of their son. They know. They could sense something's going on with Elio, which I really love. And they see how he's so jealous of Oliver at first because Oliver's getting all this attention. And, you know, he's like, oh, Dad, could I drive to the beach or whatever? And then he's like, no, Oliver, you drive it. Then Elio's just like, what?
I love that scene.
There's so many great moments that Timothy clearly improvised that weren't in the script. I loved when the relatives came by and he just did the slide and everything. Like, it's so good. And then there's that one subtle moment where the guy comes up with the fish and he's like,
yep.
It's
so good. It's so good.
But my favorite improvisation of the movie is when it's just him and Oliver. He's like, oh, are we going to be adults about this? Like, Timothy is so incredible in this. I really don't understand. But Michael Stuhlbarg, going back to him, I mean, this is a very beautiful performance. It's very raw and powerful. And that entire sequence that everybody has been talking about since this movie came out, nature has cunning ways of finding our weakest spots. Oh, my God.
It sends chills just thinking about
it. It's literally chills. And just, like, I remember just seeing that and how, like, you could hear a pin drop in that theater. Mm-hmm. I heard sniffles. It was just really rough. But really also, before that, when Elio's mom picks him up from the station, it's just that shot of him in the car. That is one of the most devastating shots I have ever seen in my entire mm-hmm. life. And it's not even the most devastating shot in this film.
Yep.
It's like, could it be more devastating than this? And then it just finds a way of topping itself. Like, oh my God. I mean, I have to go back to the music for the second, because Shuffin Stevens has really become one of my favorite artists ever. I listen to him all the time. Carrie and Lowell is one of the greatest albums I've ever heard in my life. That is a beautiful album that came out just before Call Me By Your Name was released. And when it was announced that he was writing two songs for the movie, and I remember when I first saw the trailer and I heard Mystery of Love, and I'm like, oh my God, this literally sounds like the best song ever. And it was nominated for an Oscar. Sadly did not win. It lost to Remember Me from Coco, which is a great song. So it's a very, very good song. But and then you have Visions of Gideon playing over the end. And I mean, let's just talk about that ending real quick. It's absolutely devastating. It's absolutely heartbreaking. But, you know, you brought up how it might be the best ending you've ever seen. I agree. I think it might be my favorite ending of all time as well. And this isn't even my favorite film ever made. This isn't even in my top 10 films of all time. That's just saying a lot. Yep. Like, you factor in your top 10 films and you're like, oh, the endings here are great, but
This one
hits it on the head. I mean, it just stays on him looking to the fire and crying. And I just love that very subtle shot of when he looks at the camera.
Yep.
Because it's like we're watching him cry, then he's just acknowledging us, and then it just cuts to black, and then it ends. And I remember, like, when it ended, nobody got up. Everyone just stayed in their seats until the credits were done.
Yep.
And I mean, again, this film is so universal and it's so beautiful, and it was my favorite film of 2017. It was my third favorite film of the 2010s. My number two was Whiplash, and my number one was The Social Network. Call Me By Your Name got 4 Oscar nominations, which is so just sad that it only got 4. It was nominated for Original Song, Best Actor for Timothy, Best Adapted Screenplay, which thank fucking God it won, because there was no way that any other film would have beat this, because the screenplay for this is really incredible. And of course, it was nominated for Best Picture. Luca should have been nominated for director. I would have nominated Army for supporting actor. I would have even nominated Michael Stuhlbarg.
Yep.
Cinematography, editing.
It should have had more nominations than it did.
It really should have. It really should have. And it's so crazy, too, because this was not the only Best Picture nominee that Timothy was in that year. Yeah. Because obviously Labor came out, which was, fittingly enough, my second favorite film of that year. So Timothy was in my top two films. And a fun fact is that Michael Stuhlbarg was in three Best Picture nominees that year.
He was in this,
Shape of Water, and The Post.
What a year for him.
Really, what a year. And all three different films.
Yep.
They're all different films. But my God, this film is, it's so good. And then, oh my God, it would be remiss if none of us mentioned the incredible dance sequence where Love My Way is utilized.
I think of it all the time. It's like permanently fixed in my mind.
I mean, how could you not think about it? Like, how could you not think about that? It's one of the greatest scenes of all time.
Yep.
It's so good. Oh man, it's so great. God, I mean, again, there's so much to say about Call Me By Your Name, but the reason why it's my number one is because it's the queer film that has always stuck with me, and it's weird to say always because it's only 6 years old. It doesn't even feel like this movie came out 6 years ago.
I remember
it was yesterday when the movie premiered at Sundance. Everyone talked about it, and then I saw the trailer, and then I saw the movie, and it was just really incredible, and the fact that it's left such a big impact, and I know that some people have had a harder time watching it because I know that some people are like, oh, the age gap, and oh, the Peach stuff, and oh, Armie Hammer. I understand that to some people it may not be as easy of a watch anymore, or maybe it never was an easy watch for you, but I don't know. I find so much comfort in this movie. I could watch this movie anytime for some weird reason. It's very cathartic for me. It's very therapeutic for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I watch this film to kind of ease my mind, and it really helps. And it's crazy, too, because this movie is so fucking depressing.
So sad.
And I saw this movie 3 times in theaters. I saw it during that triple feature, and then I took my, at the time, girlfriend to see it, and she didn't like it. But she did agree that Timothy is hot, so, you know, that's a win.
That, yep.
And then I saw, and I'm not even joking, I saw it 2 days after that relationship ended. And all my friends were like, why would you go see this movie again? And I'm like, I don't know.
Because I just need to hurt. I need to hurt real bad.
I need a movie that's going to hurt me, but also I just need to see this movie again so badly. And I remember one of my friends, he was like, Armie Hammer is hot, and so is Timothée Chalamet. And I'm like, yeah, they're both hot. But no, I mean, the film is incredible. It's fantastic. And really, I'm sure there's one person out there that somehow has not seen Call Me By Your Name. What are you doing? If you call yourself a film fan, you need to watch Call Me
right
By Your
now.
Name.
Go watch it right now.
Literally pause this episode, go watch Call Me By Your Name, and then come back to listen to the final couple minutes of this episode. Please. Yeah, Call Me By Your Name is our number one. And before we get into some of the films that didn't make the cut, let's recap our list from 5 to 1. So, Matthew, what is your list?
Yep. So, number 5 was Fried Green Tomatoes. Number 4, But I'm a Cheerleader. 3, Carol. 2, The Way He Looks. And 1, Call Me By Your Name.
And to recap my list, coming in number 5 is The Birdcage. Number 4 is St. Junipero, Black Mirror. Number 3 is Carol. Number 2, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And number 1, of course, is Call Me By Your Name. That is it with our list, so let's talk about some of the films that didn't make the cut. So, Matthew, just quickly go through some of your honorable mentions. What are some films that you want to give a shout-out to?
Yeah, so, you know, and there were a number of films that weren't normally, like, so one of the films on my list is not even, like, it's maybe a 3-star film, but was very influential for me, was called Alex Strangelove. This was a Netflix film that came out, I think, either the same year or a year after Love, Simon, which is another film I would shout out. And in my opinion, Alex Strangelove, I liked more. And that's because I think it had the benefit of not being a major, like, release like Love, Simon was. So Love, Simon had to do a balance. It was the first, you know, mainstream queer love story for a general audience. And Alex Strangelove was able to be a little bit more just I think a little less wholesome and a little more like an actual teenager would think. So it was a little sexier. It was a little darker. It flirted with the idea a little bit more in the ways that I think Love, Simon just couldn't. But not necessarily a great film, but was very important for where I was at the time. So those are our two big shout outs. Again, I even though they're not movies, I have to give a shout out to Bly Manor and to Heartstopper, which has its second season coming out in August. Just because I think it's important to remember, like I said, with The Way He Looks, not all queer love stories end in tragedy and heartbreak. There are positive representations out there, but you know, of course, I love a good cry. I love a good heartbreak as well. So, you know, that's kind of where I stand on some of those. What are some of the ones that you narrowly missed your list?
Well, Love, Simon is one of them. I fucking adore Love, Simon. It's so fucking good. And I liked the spinoff show, Love, Victor. I really
liked
that.
Love, Victor. Yeah.
Although they should have had one more season. Mm-hmm. I wasn't too keen on how it ended. It's like, oh, this is how it ends? Oh, okay. Not to spoil it, but that dude, I mean, oh my God. he is fine.
Yes.
He is fine.
100%.
Like, on the show, he's this nerdy-looking guy. I mean, like, he's a good-looking guy, but, like, in real life, when he has the facial hair, holy shit.
Yep.
It's next level. And then I saw images of him on Never Have I Ever, which is a show that I unfortunately have never seen. And I
it's
need
on
to
my
watch
list.
It.
Yep.
And I saw those images, and I was like, holy shit. Like, damn, what the fuck? Michael Cimino, oh my God. Other honorable mentions, Pain and Glory, which I brought briefly a little earlier. Antonio Banderas in that is so incredible.
Yep.
That was a fantastic performance. And that was my first Almodovar film. And I loved it so much. Dog Day Afternoon is not your conventional queer film. But it has a bit of a queer storyline in it. And it's kind of pivotal to the story a bit, but it's also one of the best films I've ever seen. I mean, it's really one of the most high-octane thrillers you will ever watch, and it's one of the best one-location films of all time. It's really, really wonderful. Moonlight, of course. I mean, you can't talk about queer films now without mentioning Moonlight. Best Picture winner, one of the best films of the past 10 years. Really, really game changer. Happiest Season, which we did briefly touch upon.
Go check it out, people. It's so good.
It's so, so good. One of my absolute favorite films of 2020. It was right outside my top 10 that year. I loved it so much. Jennifer's Body, man.
Oh,
Jennifer's Body.
Ooh, that's a good pick.
That was very close to making my top 5. I never thought in my life that I would love Jennifer's Body, because for years I had pushed it off because I'm like, this is definitely not a film that I'm going to love, even though Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried are two of the finest people ever. But I watched it on Halloween 2021 for the first time, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is amazing. A great coming of age, horror, comedy, queer film. I love it so much. Oh man, there's just so many. Would you include The Favorite as a queer film?
I absolutely would. I would, and that, it would be in my top 10 for sure.
That is another one that's so great. My favorite moment, I like when she sticks her tongue down my throat.
What a movie. What a movie.
That film is, oh my God, one of the best, should have won best screenplay. It's sickening that it didn't. Beginners, Mike Mills, great
yep.
stuff. Christopher Plummer. As a man who comes out way later in his life, fantastic. And, I mean, who doesn't love Ewan McGregor? Brokeback Mountain. I mean, come on. Brokeback Mountain.
Yep.
Again, you want to talk about two non-gay actors playing gay characters beautifully? I mean,
check
God.
It out. Yep.
God, it's just so, so wonderful. Oh, there's a few more. I'm trying to think of more.
Oh, I would also recommend, it's a little weird classifying it, but Closer, which was the film mm-hmm. from just this past year, deeply depressing. One of the sadder movies I've ever seen.
I need to see that. I still haven't seen that. I wasn't able to see it when it came out. I missed it in theaters, and I really want to check that out. Man, there's just so many to talk about. I mean, where do I even start? I don't know. I have to, I know there's gonna be some that come to
It's
mind
gonna come
much
to you
later
later,
on that
yep.
I forgot. I
Oh, I
know, I
also love
just
Bros. Not,
Bros.
you know, I just, so many people were so hard on Bros.
I agree.
And I think for what it was a damn good rom-com. And people are
It
so
really
critical
was.
of it. I had a blast watching that film, and I enjoyed it just as much the second and third time.
It was so fucking funny. It was so good. And Billy Eichner, I fucking love. I've
I
always
love,
loved
yep.
Billy Eichner. I love Billy on the Street. I love his cameos in films. I think he was one of the only good things about the
Lion
Lion
King,
King
yep,
remake. And yeah, I love that movie. I think it was beautifully written, beautifully directed, very universal. Just truly love that film. And it has a Night at the Museum tie-in that I never thought I
But
wanted.
I needed it. I
But I
loved
needed it.
it.
But I needed it. And really, that's it with the honorable mentions for me. I mean, there's so many other films that come to mind for sure, but there's also so many films that I have to see. I need to see so many films. And, you know, to close out, what are your final thoughts on queer films? Like, what's the last things that you want to say before we close out tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I'm most excited about is that we are able to start to tell stories that are not only ending in tragedy. And you know, I know there's a big trope of bury your gays, and it's a very valid concern that people have. I think you can, there's still some real quality movies that have that trope. It doesn't make them less deserving, but I am so glad that people are starting to express just queer joy and in a lot of its different ways. And I'm excited to see, you know, Fire Island came out just a couple years ago, and that was a great new take on the genre. So I'm excited to see kind of where queer films go from here, because I think you're going to get more stories about trans people. You're going to get more of these classic, you know, you're getting non-binary and asexual, and you know, there, it's such a broad spectrum, and more voices are being heard. And it's also not that the plot of the stories are not always going to be this is a gay person and this is their gay experience. It's just this is a person and they happen to be gay, and that really excites me as well.
Absolutely. I'm the exact same way as you. I love that we're getting more of these stories now. I think it's great that we are getting these stories because it's about time that we get the people in this community to have their voices heard and experiences brought to the screen, hopefully by people who actually genuinely care about bringing these stories to life. But also, a lot of these films, again, they find a way of being universal to everybody. Like, again, some of the pretty much all these films that we talked about today, you could like them even if you're not a member of the community. And that's the thing that's so beautiful about film, period. Like, I love Catch Me If You Can. I never impersonated a pilot, but somehow I love the movie. I love Back to the Future. I never went back in time to see my parents as kids, but I love the film. I mean, I know those are silly examples. Harry Potter, I didn't go to a school with wizards and witches, like, but I love it. That's the beautiful thing about film. We're placed into these worlds and environments with these characters, and we find a way of finding some relatability to them and something that we could take away. And all these films that we talked about today have such a beautiful message, and I'm glad that these films exist, and I'm so glad that we're getting more of these films, hands down.
100%.
Matthew, I loved having you on. I'm so happy that you came on. Thank you so much for coming on today to talk to me about the best queer
Of
films.
course. Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun, and I hope I might come back again sometime.
Absolutely. I would love to have you back on again. And where could the people find you online?
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram and Letterboxd. That's going to be MattSoto94.
And you guys can follow me on all social medias at Brian Suffield. You guys can subscribe to the show on any podcast or platform. Rate and review, share this around. We have a Twitter and Instagram so you guys can stay up to date with what's going on in Film Fragments. We have a lot of great episodes coming your way, so please be on the lookout for that. Let us know your favorite queer films. I'm so curious to hear you guys' list. Do you also have Call Me By Your Name at number one just like us? If not, it's totally fine, but I might have to say a few things. And I'm just kidding, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really appreciate it. And I will see you guys for the very next episode of Film Fragments. Take care, everybody.